1991, and this is Shahla Khairi interviewing Mr. Nader Ardalan for the oral history project for Foundation for Iranian Studies. Mr. Ardalan, it's really lovely that you accepted to talk to me. Could I please ask you to start by saying something about your family background and your upbringing? Your father, your mother, your siblings, if you'd like.
Thank you, Shahla. I'd be very happy to. And it's a pleasure to be participating in this program, albeit I'm only an architect. My family background has played a dominant role, I believe, in my own formation, principally because my parents had been involved with the Western world in their own lives before I came into being, and therefore they probably were one of the first families in Iran that were experiencing the interaction between the Occident and the Orient as far as contemporary Persians were concerned. My father was Abbas Quli Ardalan. He was born in Hamadan in 1900, and he was one of five sons of Fakhr al-Mulk Ardalan, who had been, of course, one of the senior representatives of Kurdistan in the Qajar series of family reigns. And prior to that, the Ardalan family takes great pride in documenting their origins back to Saladin Ayyub in the early periods of 12th, 13th centuries, and mythically going all the way back to the time of the Prophet Muhammad and the early beginnings of Hassan and Hussein in the areas that concerned interaction between Iran and Iraq as an area, a regional area at that time. So the family was, the family name was indoctrinated into our very beginnings as young children as being a very important aspect, and the key element to it was nobility, nobility of correct behavior, of good deeds, and of value to country, and of patriotism and love of country. This was deeply ingrained in us as children. On the other side, my mother, Farangisa Ardalan, was one of two daughters, one of four children of Ali Akbar Dabar, and only two daughters from his first marriage. Ali Akbar Dabar, of course, again, very much a individual whose picture is here in our room, there on the right.
Yes, yes, I see.
And of course, an individual who held, who has been held in great respect because of his early contributions in the 1920s and 30s to the formation of contemporary Iranian financial and judicial system. He was educated in Europe, in Belgium and Switzerland, and brought back into Iran a important contribution in the development of contemporary legal system of Iran. Of course, my mother's family came from Shiraz, and so from the plains of Shiraz to the mountains of Kurdistan, we children grew up in the valley between the low and the high place. the aspect of my own upbringing, immediately I remember as an image in World War II, when Iran was occupied by the Allies, and we had a small courtyard home in Hilbanikah, and I remember it had two gardens. The front garden had a lovely little hose, little fountain, and a orchard of sorts with quince and pomegranate trees.
Yeah.
And the back garden held vast cherry tree orchards, and that was a great source of joy as a young boy, that one day my father planted in the ground an apricot seed, and over the years I remember that this tree grew and it gave fruit, and that was such a tremendous sense of reassurance that life actually with your own hands could be perpetuated. In any case, I grew up in this courtyard house from birth to the age of seven.
How many siblings did you have?
And of course, my sister, Patty, was 10 years older than I, and she, with my mom and dad, had spent her early youth being educated in Belgium, because my father was, after he received his education at the Dr. Jordan's school, at the age of 15 or so, he graduated. He then worked, but at the early mid-career, he went to England, where he studied at the London School of Economics. This was now in the 30s, and my mother and sister went also to Europe and lived in Europe for a few years while he was carrying out his studies. He came back with a very incredible document. My father wrote three large volumes on the entire British Mint, its operation, its structure, and even the equipment that was used in the production of the British Mint. And he in time helped set up the treasury of Iran and was the first treasurer.
Was it his own personal interest, or did he have some inclination that it might eventually be used by the government?
Dalvar, my father, his father-in-law, commissioned him to journey to make such a study, because this was part of the modernization of Iran, and so my father's task as a person in the financial and the banks was to go to England to carry out this study in economics, and then to document the British Mint, the functioning of the contemporary treasury.
And that was in the 1930s?
That was in 1930s. So they then came back, and in the period of the war, my father held, I guess, a number of positions. He was both the treasurer of Iran. He was also responsible for the import and export of Iran with regards to major trade. This caused a tremendous antagonism because he was a very honest man, and during a war, you can imagine that such a position would be very ripe for graft. And his life was threatened several times because he would have no part of that. And so I remember that we actually had a threat on his life, and that precipitated a policeman that would live in our home and a second policeman that would escort my father or our family wherever we went during the war.
Do you know who made the threat, from whom it came?
I guess it must have come from some of the groups that were interested in making a quick buck out of the import-export. You know, they were bringing, the U.S. Army was bringing, you know, a number of, for instance, rubber tires that would be then through the Bridge of Victory, which was Iran's mm-hmm. name, to supply the Soviet Union during the war. And so you can imagine lots of inexpensive things being brought into a country, and then people would love to sell it on the black market. So I think it was the black marketeers mm-hmm. who had made this threat. In any case, we then became highly conscious of the preciousness of this small group, my mother, my father, my sister and I. And then, of course, my aunt and her husband, the Azerbaijanis, who lived next door to us, and then my grandmother. This was a very close-knit family. And also the Ardalan family was very close-knit. The five Ardalans, who was essentially the eldest, by the time, of course, I had come into being, my grandfather had passed away, Tahrirmut had passed away, but I do remember my grandmother, Shahjan, all immaculate in white, a very tiny, beautiful lady, and she had given birth to a most incredible group of men, because the eldest was Hajj al-Mamalik, who in many of the regimes was minister and later in his life senator. And then there was Nasser Ghuli Khan, who played a very important role later during the Mossadegh period as the individual who actually went down to Abadan and closed the refinery to the British. Mm. And then there was of course Dr. Ali Ghuli Ardalan, who was our ambassador to the United States, prior to that to the United Nations, and then subsequent to the United States, Iran ambassador to the Soviet Union. My father
was the fourth
one. Dr. Ali Ghuli Ardalan was the youngest one. The third eldest was Amir Amjad Ardalan, whose sons particularly distinguished themselves in both the field of diplomacy and the professional field. Amir Amjad's eldest son is Ahmad Ardalan, who was our ambassador to the Soviet Union in the mid-70s, and Majid Ardalan, his youngest brother, who was a civil engineer, helped in the construction of the Karaj Dam with Morrison Knudsen, and in time developed one of the very fine construction companies, Milli Sakhtaman, National Construction Company in Iran, and devoted much of his life to building in the Khuzestan region.
It seems that most of these Ardalan men had also sons. Did they have any daughters?
Of course they did. In fact, one of the... Yes, the ladies of the family certainly have a distinguished career, and I'll just indicate one of them. Merabdas Mustofi, one of the daughters of Pakhormurt, one of these two sisters of the five brothers that I have mentioned, had, of course, Bagher Mustofi, who was the board of directors of the National Oil Company, and then later on general director of the National Petrochemical Company, and his two sisters, Mehri Safinya and Huri Mogaddam. These ladies grew in great stature as very strong individuals in Iran. Mehri Safinya started the Safinya School, which was a very fine school in Tehran, and then in time became a member of parliament. And Huri Mogaddam started a number of the international ladies associations, I think Zanta International and some others. Now, you know, in measuring the male and female, we have to address it with relationship to the Iranian condition. The fact that you might have been a member of parliament is not necessarily a measure of a traditional measure of Iranian women's role and significance. I think that many of the mothers really were classic mothers in that they devoted an entire life to the household, to the house, to the raising of the children, to a very, very fine structured life for the family. Certainly I remember with fondness the many, many, many years spent in our home with my mom, and who's still, of course, with us. Now, that has generally been the family background. I do want to say a word about my sister and her husband, because they have played a very vital role in my life. Paddy Malek married Isa Malek in the United States when we were living in America back in 1950s. And Isa, of course, spent a number of years in the foreign ministry, and serving in both Switzerland and later on in Iran. In the foreign ministry, he rose to several ranks, particularly during the period of the 70s. He was the director of protocol at the royal court, and had a very a significant role with relationship to the visiting dignitaries that came to Iran. I also had the pleasure of designing a one of my several private residences for my sister and her husband in Tehran, in Puri Rumi. Again, later on when we talk about the idea of architecture, they were very instrumental in supporting, again, the idea of integrating the Iranian traditions with contemporary needs in the house that I designed for them.
Where are they now?
They now live in Virginia, in the United States. They have three children, two daughters, Didi, Niamir, and Minu, and Ali, who's just finished college. Now...
So you were talking about yourself leaving Iran at the age of seven.
Oh, yes, of course. So it came to be that after World War II had ended, the Marshall Plan and the 4.4 plan that were American aid programs to countries that had helped the Allies during the war was going to also be given to Iran. To negotiate that loan and to start that program in Iran, my father was selected as the financial attaché of Iran to the United States. And so in 1946-47, we migrated, my mother, my sister, my father and I, to Washington, D.C. We went, of course, through the circuitous routes of great departures from the old Mehrabad Airport, where at least 1,000 people came off to say goodbye. And then, of course, the two-motored airplane flew from Tehran to Baghdad, and Baghdad was clouded in, so they had to return.
Back
to Tehran, where it had to land. And this process of goodbyes went on for 3 or 4 times, progressively the crowds getting smaller, until the last time it was just the immediate family. But in any case, we made our way through to England, and then boat to Montreal, and then train to Washington, D.C.
Did your father have an official assignment?
Yes, he was the financial attaché of the embassy. So from the late 40s, for a period of 5 years, we lived in Washington, D.C., and I essentially went to elementary school in America and started from the first grade, although I had, I guess, gone to kindergarten school and to first grade in Iran. And I remember with great fondness a number of plays that I had participated in. In fact, I remember my first drawings, my first attraction to painting had occurred in Iran. We had been to movies, which at that time were, you know, a tremendous recreation source for everyone. And the minute I came home, I drew what I had seen, and my parents tell me that I was at that time 5 years old, and they said that this young man must have some artistic inclination. And so from the age of 5, I had a tutor that would essentially practice my sketching and my drawing. So from a very early age, I had my artistic side very much nurtured.
Was it more like a khattat?
No. It was an instructor that would teach me life anatomy and the drawing of objects. When I was in Washington, I continued with this interest. I was enrolled in the Corcoran Gallery of Art as a boy of 8 or 9, and for several years I carried out still life drawing, pastel, charcoal drawing, and I remember with a great sense of personal pride that I could at least reward my parents' support of me, that I was given many honors and awards at the Corcoran Gallery of Art for the work that I had done. At year's end, you know, they would display the work that the students had done, and some of these were selected for first prize. So my family background and my education now become really intertwined. From the late 40s until 1964, I stayed in the United States, moving in the mid-50s to New York, where my father took an assignment with the representing Iran at the United Nations in one of the capacities dealing with, again, financial and trade matters. And we live in Westchester County. I went through a wonderful period of going through the Boy Scouts in those years. I remember that I rose to an Eagle Scout. It was a wonderful, wonderful period of my life. I loved the outdoors. I loved going out into the wilderness. And this had been very much a part of my upbringing in Iran, because the family were noted as great hunters, small game hunters. And so I remember my family in Iran always going out every weekend to hunt. So the idea that I could at least carry out as a youth in America was to go hiking on weekends with the Boy Scout program.
Did you get a chance to go back to Iran every now and then during the time you were in America?
No. We really stayed in America, and I did not return to Iran until 1959, when I went back for a summer visit. It was, I believe, after my sophomore year of college. Other than that, I had stayed all that period of time. About 18 years I lived in the United States. Now, after completing my high school education in New Rochelle, New York, I was given a very nice scholarship by the American Institute of Architects to study architecture at Carnegie Institute of Technology, which is now called Carnegie Mellon University. And really, the impetus to go into architecture came because of several factors. One is that I had always this artistic inclination. Two, however, my father had great hopes that his son would become an engineer. And the third was that for a number of years, when my father and mother moved back to Iran, and before my commencement of college, I lived 2 years with a family in New Rochelle whose father was an architect. He was a German architect, Gunther Arndt, and his wife Erna, and their two sons, Gunther Jr. and Peter. And with these people, who lived on a very modest means, they were rebuilding their home, which was in this beautiful old barn. And they had started from one corner, and they had entirely rebuilt this barn. And I lived with them during at least a half of the process, where we came home on the weekends and we would saw wood and we would, plane wood. I learned enormous amount about the treatment of wood and how you would rub, for instance, lemon oil into the finished wood to get the full grain out of mahogany. And I grew to love materials. He, in time, of course, wrote a beautiful letter supporting my candidacy for the study of architecture. And when the scholarship came for Carnegie Mellon, it synthesized, crystallized my future. So really, at about the age of 17, I went to a five-year program, and I graduated in 1961 with a Bachelor's of Architecture degree. Architecture was as though it had been meant for me. It was like a glove and hand relationship. It fitted me absolutely beautifully, all my temperament, my artistic as well as my more technical dimensions were geared into union with this profession. I went from the 1960s on to graduate degree work at Harvard University. I came to Boston. Here I met a number of my lifelong friends. Of course, growing up in New York and in Washington, we had come across a very small community of Iranians who had lived there. the Lajavardis, Habib Lajavardi, with whom later on I was to build the Iran Center for Management Studies, and his brothers, with whom I was later on to build the Gruh-e Sanati Behshar. These were people that I had met in the early 50s as a young man growing up in the small Iranian community that was there. Now this explains a lot of why my interview today is in English. I have never received any formal training in Farsi. I have spent all of my life essentially academically being trained in English. Although my mother and father valiantly tried to bring Iranian books to my attention when I was in school, it was really difficult as a young son of an immigrant family growing up in America, keeping up with everybody in English, to at the same time do double duty and learn Farsi, especially because there was no supporting community of any size to support the Persian language. There was no Persian schools, and you know, in the late 1940s, perhaps there might have been six or seven families. That was the extent of the Iranian community in Washington. In any case, I want to say something about that, because philosophically I had to at some point come to grips with the language. My real feeling is that it's the world of ideas that count. And if you are able to grasp essential ideas, then the language in which they are grasped is secondary to the primary notions that are involved. So my work later on, as I'll describe, in the study of traditional Persian architecture, which had a lot to do with the study of Persian philosophy, I feel perfectly at ease with the philosophy of Iran related to architecture without having necessarily to be fluent in Farsi. I did, however, grow 14 years in Iran, where I established a major firm, and I had to carry out a lot of work in my native language, and this somehow was miraculously accomplished.
But that's an interesting point. I mean, on the one hand, you came here at such an early, at such a young age, and you seem to be so much at ease with the philosophy and ideas. How did that come about? You know, I mean, architecture is more or less more within the realm of sciences rather than, you know, philosophy. Of course, there is a philosophy of architecture, but how did it come about for you to have this love affair with the philosophy and ideas that are so deeply rooted in Iranian culture?
Well, I think we're progressing in our discussion more or less chronologically, so I guess we'll get to that and very shortly. In 1964, I had already graduated. I had been working in San Francisco for 3 or 4 years, building my first major buildings at the University of California and in the city of San Francisco. And it became very apparent to me that work in a professional office in the United States was very predictable. And I could see in the 40, 50-year associates in that firm that in a matter of 20 or 30 years, I would be as they. So I could see myself mirrored in them. At the same time, I had, I guess, the psychological longing for my roots and my personal identity, and thus, coincidence would have it, in 1963 and 4, as you know, Iran began another cycle of its contemporary history, It was reaching outward to have Iranian trained professionals return to Iran. It was the beginning of a growth period. It had gone through a major situation in the mid-50s with the nationalization of oil. By the mid-60s, it was in a position to now reap the benefits of some of that nationalization, and it had the need for professional cadre. And therefore, there was a reaching out of by various institutions in Iran to seek Iranians who had been trained abroad to come back. And so the National Oil Company of Iran was looking for a chief architect. And I was a candidate. I was selected, and my family and I, and of course now I have to mention that in the late 50s, I met my first wife, Lale Bakhtiar. We, in time, had three children together, but in the early 60s that I'm now discussing, my first two children, Mani, Helen, Ardalan, was born, who is now a architect, fine architect, working.
Your sons or your daughter? Hmm? Which one?
My daughter, my eldest daughter. We named her Mani in honor of the great painter Mani, and at the same time, in honor of my mother, whose name we had nicknamed Mani, and everyone in my family called my mother Mani. This is to indicate the mentality, though. You see, we had stayed in America so long that we thought we would forever stay in America. And because my parents had come back to Iran, we thought we would never see my mother again. And so you name your first child in honor of your mother, and that's how this remained. Of course, my second child is named Iran, and you can see already the mental associations with the country. She was born in 1962, and in 1964 we did return. We went to Masjid Suleiman with the oil company. We spent 2 years with the oil company, and
just may I ask you this question about your wife? Was she also one of the Iranian immigrant in America, and what was she doing here?
Yes, Lale was one of many children that the late Dr. Abul Qasem Bakhtiar had. And she was living in America with her mother, with her American mother, Helen. And she was in college in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where Carnegie Mellon is located. And we met on a blind date, as chance would have it. That is what she was doing.
Okay.
In the 1964 to 66, we lived in Masjid Suleiman. This was a very, very important transitional period for me, because all of my education in the United States had trained me in a very empirical way about architecture. But when I went back to Iran, I found great difficulty understanding the architecture, the traditional architecture of Iran, because it was somehow not based upon the same principles as Western architecture, which had been my early training. During this period of time, I was fortunate in meeting Dr. Roman Gershman, who was the great French archaeologist who had first excavated Shush, and then was excavating systematically all of the Parthian and Sassanid, and of course later Achaemenid monuments in Khuzestan. His architect had fallen ill and he needed someone to draw his fines. And so I went, I volunteered to be his architect, and on weekends when I was not working with the oil company, I would draw these archaeological fines. And this was a very important item, to see that with a paintbrush, a little half-inch paintbrush, these archaeologists would dust away the thousands of years of history to find a stone, a threshold to a, for instance, Bar-de-Nishande, which was one of the precursors to Persepolis that was built there in Khuzestan, near to Masjid Suleiman. And I think that deepened in me the value of architecture, that in time, if you were to build symbolically, if you were to build with strength, and that things would remain, that there would be a heritage that would value this. And this left profound impressions on me. Still, I was not quite in a state of understanding, but I began systematically to photograph and to draw the traditional architecture of Isfahan, of Kashan, of Kerman, of Yazd, and of course of the traditional great pre-Islamic monuments as well. About this time, 1966, the University of Chicago was looking for someone to write a book on Persian architecture, and my name was brought to their attention. So it happened that I was commissioned in 1966 by the University of Chicago to write a book on architecture. It took me quite some time to really complete that book.
Did you have to come here for it?
No, no. I just needed more research. And so it took about 3 years to complete that work, because I wasn't satisfied that just simply photographing and measuring architecture would give me the answers that I sought. Because the question I was asking was, what were the root philosophical and theoretical basis of Persian architecture? And when you do something Aristotelian, which is to measure the outside and to measure how a brick fits onto a brick, all that you understand is what came to be known later as the Zahir answer, the manifest answer. But what was lovely about what was becoming slowly illuminated in my mind was that Iranian architecture and life, its philosophy and its arts and its music, had a batin, had an inner meaning. And without the inner meaning, the outer meaning would never have been made manifest. So I worked years at trying to understand this. I took the Aristotelian method of documenting for 3 years. At that time, 1966, I came back to Tehran. I joined
from Masjid
Suleiman. I was made a senior member of the firm of Abdelaziz Farman Farmayan, who was a very fine architect, who had I had come to know because he had been one of the persons who had performed certain services of design for the oil company. So in my position as chief architect for the oil company, I had met all the architects of Iran, more or less, and he impressed me as an individual who had very fine capabilities that I would like to become associated with. So from 1966 to 72, for 6 years, and in time I became his partner. And in time, this office, when I joined, was about 10 people. In time, this office grew to be more than 200 people. But I had two layers of interest when I came to Tehran. One was my theoretical layer, and one was my actual professional, functional role. The breadwinner, the other one, the seeker of the soul. The seeker of the soul went to Tehran University to teach for free. The breadwinner joined Aziz Farmerfarmanyan and designed, first we designed the Saman Towers. This was a very, very interesting, I think, cultural statement. In the 60s, there was a tremendous West toxication, as we now know this word so well. We didn't know the word West toxication, but most of us who were working and were concerned and who were thoughtful knew that there was something about this idea in the air. But nevertheless, there were tremendous involvement with trying to bring Western image into our daily life, into Iran. At least certain stratas of Iranian society. When the first luxury apartment buildings were to be built, Aziz Farmerfarmanyan was commissioned to do this, and he was involved with a group of people, Ahmad Ebtehaj, and several people from Simon Tehran, who were a group of his old friends from Europe. They were putting some funds together to develop what was going to be Iran's first high-rise luxury apartments. Since I had had experience in doing high-rise buildings in San Francisco, with the firm, I was the person chosen to design this building. Originally, one of these buildings was to have been an office and one to be an apartment. And so the idea of the image of the building grew in this, in a certain way. In time, of course, both buildings became apartment buildings, and apparently when they were designed and constructed, they were very successful. They sold right away. But into these buildings, a few things are important to note. First of all, Iran in the late 60s had a tremendous labor problem. We should always